You're listening to Locked On Cavaliers, your daily look at the Cleveland Cavaliers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Hello and welcome to this episode of Locked On Cavaliers, your daily look at the Cleveland Cavaliers. I'm Chris Manning, your host and the site manager at FearTheSword.com, SB Nation's Cleveland Cavaliers site. As always, you can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. A 5-star review on Apple Podcasts is the best way to support the show. And thanks to everyone who is listening has already given us that great review over there. Today's show is a conversation with Caitlin Cooper. She is a great writer. She writes at Indy Cornrows, SB Nation's Pacers blog. And we talk about what the Pacers and how they were able to be successful after losing Paul George could teach the Cavs. Now, that is obviously a very different scenario than what situation the Cavs are in. The Cavs lost LeBron for nothing. The Pacers were able to get Victor Oladipo and Domantas Sabonis from the Thunder in exchange for PG. And obviously, Oladipo is a star, and Sabonis is shooting like a bajillion percent for the field this year. The Cavs didn't get anything like that. So there is some differences there that we have to account for. But I think the Pacers are a template, and to some degree at least, of what the Cavs would like to be in a post-LeBron world. So I think Caitlin's a great person to talk to. We talk a little bit about what you might see in tonight's Cavs-Pacers game as well near the end of the show. You can find her on Twitter at C2_Cooper. Again, find her writing at Indy Cornrows. Without further ado, here's me and Caitlin and talking about Cavs-Pacers and what the Cavs could learn from Indiana. Obviously, Campaign is going to be with the Cavs for this game as well, so we'll see if he plays or how much he plays, and no Patrick McCaw, and that's just a weird scenario. But Campaign's not very good. He's there for depth, and I don't think he's much of anything. I'd rather would have kept McCaw if I was the Cavs, but it is what it is. It doesn't matter too much right now, but without further ado, here's my conversation with Caitlin Cooper from Indy Cornrows. Thanks for listening. So I want to start with the Pacers and how they actually got competent. I think broadly speaking, and not obviously player for player or style for style, but success-wise, the Cavs would like to be the Pacers. They would like to be a mid-market team in the Midwest that has a passionate fan base that cares and has a team that is competitive and good and not, you know, overly dominant or based on one player. They built this team. Now, tell me exactly how you think this Pacers team came together, but obviously they were able to get Oladipo and get Domantas Sabonis, two real cogs to this current team in the Paul George trade. But were those the two big moves? What would you say actually was the roster wise the reason Indiana is now successful in the way they are?
I think you got to give a lot of credit to Kevin Pritchard. Obviously, you know, a lot of us, me included, I guess I shouldn't include everybody, but at least me, questioned the trade when it happened. And, you know, early into last season, it was pretty evident that Oladipo's skilled agility was a legitimate thing and that Sabonis was blossoming, moving from, you know, makeshift power forward that he was in Oklahoma City to being a five. And I think really with that, once you had two pieces that were showing promise, then the stuff that Kevin Pritchard had done around them over the summer, you know, he was just really smart in how he structured contracts, because by signing Darren Collison and Bojan Bogdanovic to partially guaranteed deals, there were just a lot of different ways that they could go. And as it turned out, they were, you know, the surprise team of the season heading into the trade deadline, and they would have been able to have a lot of options if they weren't. I know some of the stuff that was tossed around, they could have, I think Kenneth Fareed, like getting a player like that and taking on bad contracts to get picks, or Damari Carroll was an option, but he had six players come to the office and ask and say, you know, let us play this out to the end. And he decided to keep the roster together. And I think just making smart decisions like that, where he isn't tying up money long term, but at the same time, they also have like this base culture that those players wanted to play there. They all work, they fit, as you say, they just have a lot of balance. I mean, even this season, they have, I think, 21 games with six players in double figures. So, and now again, you know, they went into last summer and instead of trying to, you know, skip steps or, you know, retool, they just made really conservative upgrades, and they have, you know, seven players on 1-year deals. So at the end of this season, they'll have a lot of options again. Whereas, you know, if they really have some success in the playoffs, they could try to re-sign their own free agents, or they can, you know, almost clear the slate and build around Victor and Sabonis and Miles again. But, you know, they have a good balance of young talent. Plus, they weren't barren. They didn't give up picks whenever Paul George was still here. They didn't give up a lot of that stuff. I think right now the only pick of theirs that's potentially owed to somebody is a second rounder from the Nets deal when they got Thad. So.
So I don't, this is somewhat of a loaded question, but when Indiana trades Paul George and gets Sabonis and gets Oladipo, and obviously they may not acknowledge some of this publicly, but did you feel like they were trying to compete, or were they playing a rebuilding game? And obviously they, you know, they pushed the Cavs last year. They looked to be one of the best teams in the East this year. Do you think they actually expected to be on this timeline that they are right now when they traded Paul George away?
Oh no. I mean, I think that the degree of the leap that Oladipo took, I think Kevin Pritchard himself has even admitted, I don't think they expected it to be that far. But at the same time, they have an ownership and the sign and Herb Simon that they don't want to be a team that completely, you know, takes it down to the studs. That's not going to be something the Pacers do. So my guess is they expected that they might be rebuilding through the middle as they've done so many times. I shouldn't speak to this, but I doubt that they expected that they were going to be that competitive in the playoffs and be, you know, crushing their over under win projection before the All-Star break last year. So no, I wouldn't guess that they thought that they would be this far ahead, but obviously I'm not them. But Kevin Pritchard basically admitted to that he didn't see the leap that Oladipo made to the extent that it was.
So when you look at this team as having an identity, as having obviously they Oladipo and Sabonis and the guys they have and hitting on those guys has mattered. That matters more than anything. But in terms of Nate McMillan, in terms of Kevin Pritchard, in terms of the overall organizational structure and everything that we sort of know about Indiana, what about their organization and the relationships guys have, or just like the style they've tried to implement, has set them up for success? Is there something about the overall plan they've had that to you seems to be a reason like why they're playing the way they are?
That stuff is kind of hard to write about because it's so hard to measure, but it's undeniable when you watch them play. And I think there's about three things you can look at there because when Nate McMillan was hired, I have the suspicion, it's never actually been confirmed, but I suspicion that Larry Bird kind of knew that he would be stepping down in the near future when they decided not to keep Frank Vogel, and not that these two decisions were connected, but that when Nate McMillan was hired, they didn't actually have like a public interview process. Now, I don't know if they made contacts with other candidates, but it was pretty in short order that Nate McMillan was the next coach. And with the ties that they have there with Kevin Pritchard, it seemed like they're setting up a table. And Kevin Pritchard and Nate, obviously from their time in Portland, they have a working relationship. They can draw on past shared experiences, and you can just tell, like at last season's postseason presser, Kevin Pritchard actually kind of choked up just talking about Nate McMillan and some of the growth that he showed as a coach last season. And you just know that there's solid organizational stability and a power structure there that's gonna work. And then having a player like Victor, Kevin Pritchard also talks about this a lot, that he's just constantly positive. They went through like a brief losing streak last year, and they tell the story that Kevin Pritchard came into the workout facility and Victor was he was just like whistling, and Kevin's like, aren't you a little bit, you know, worried or, you know, beat up about where the team is right now? And Victor's like, I just know that we're gonna be okay with it. And they have between Victor, Thaddeus Young, they just have people that are there to police their own locker room. And they also got leadership last year and this season from like guys like Al Jefferson or a Kyle O'Quinn, who are veterans who accepted the role that, you know, you're going to be a mentor and stay ready to play. We'll need you to play in the case of emergency. But really, they're more like keeping Kyle O'Quinn's a guy that keeps it light. Big Al was a guy that, you know, kind of policed the locker room and stayed in the ears of players like Miles Turner and Domantas Sabonis to offer advice. And Nate McMillan himself, I know, plays a big role in setting that culture because at the beginning of the year, he was doing a presser and they said he mentioned a pet peeve that he would share at like a team dinner, which was don't F with the game, which essentially what he means with that is that the Pacers are a team that whether they're up 20 or they're down 20, they're going to play hard, and that's pretty important because of how vital forcing turnovers is for them. And I'm sure like Cavs fans who are listening to this are probably thinking, yeah, in that last matchup they weren't playing all that hard, but in general that was an aberration from the norm. But yeah, I mean, I think that their chemistry and their culture is a huge factor. I mean, it has to be, because like I said earlier, they have seven players on 1 year deals. That could go sideways in a hurry if they didn't have people on the inside that were managing egos and people that were willing to put that aside for team goals. So I think that's a big part of it. And it, I mean, that's a contrast, I would guess, with how, you know, the situation with them hiring Larry Drew 6 games into the season and him not really being a permanent coach right now.
Yeah, so we'll wrap the first part of this up on Nate McMillan, but just hit with my follow-up question to him is like, I did not think he was necessarily like a good coach when he took over that team. I had sort of weirdly low expectations for him. I came away very impressed what he did against the Cavs in the playoffs last year. I think that roster is sort of well suited for what he seems to want to do. What is it about him to you that has made him successful in the market with this type of franchise? With everything that just sort of is in place right now, what about Nate it has made him the right coach for Indiana? What attributes do you think are the biggest in terms of him being a good fit for this team?
I mean, I know that there's a lot of stories out there where, you know, Victor, since last year, was having some trouble figuring out how to adjust to team switching against him, and Nate McMillan went down and told him, like, you know, here's what you're gonna do. You're gonna retreat dribble. And they saw this a lot in the Cavs series last year when he would get a switch on a big, he'd retreat dribble and just go right into the defense and launch into those pull-up threes. And, you know, little one-on-one conversations like that. I know earlier in the season too, he met with Tyreek about, you know, go back to your days of when you're on the playground. That's what type of we need from you. And Tyreek's been up and down, but I think he has a rapport with the players. I think he also is a guy, like I said, with that don't F with the game. I think he's a culture setter. And, you know, I still have some qualms with the whole valuing mid-range shots over threes, especially with how good the Pacers shoot the three-point shot. But I
As
think
the Cavs here, I as someone who covers the Cavs, I can tell you that I am over the I can mid oh, teams overvalue still overvalue mid-range shots, and it's not great.
exactly. I mean, but I think there's also something to be said about, in the Pacers' case, of that he's just let players be themselves. And I think there's a certain degree of freedom with that. I mean, is it tantalizing to wonder how much higher their ceiling could be if they took threes? Absolutely, it is. But I think that there's also a trust in knowing that they, you know, this is, I'm Miles Turner and I'm comfortable from this range. And maybe other teams too, maybe they cause consternation from other teams because so many other teams are worried about guarding the 3-point line in today's NBA. And, you know, that works for them. It's just been a constant, which that's sort of Dan Burke in addition to Nate. He's the defensive coordinator. But yeah, I mean, I had a few questions about some of the stuff that he did in the playoffs, some decisions with whether he played Miles or Sabonis, and then obviously LeBron's late game shot when he had a timeout and a foul to give and they didn't use it. There's a few things like that that I wondered about, and we'll see how that develops. But he's also just shown some growth. I mean, his first year when he was coaching, just as an example, they'd play a regular season game, and like, let's say they're playing the Raptors, he would have Monte Ellis guard DeMar DeRozan because, and he would say, guard their positions, which I get that to an extent because he means they're not going to switch. The Pacers aren't a team that do that, they drop and tag. But 2 years later, now he's the coach who a lot of what the Pacers do defensively is successful because they let Victor roam. They'll put him on the weaker wing, let Bojan Bogdanovic guard the stronger wing, and let Victor get into those gaps. And that isn't something that he was doing 2 years ago. And I think that he deserves a lot of credit for some of those adjustments and things that he's done over the last 2 years that have made the team better and things that he's been willing to adjust to. I mean, he's playing lineups with Doug McDermott and Bojan Bogdanovic together, which is another thing you would not have seen 2 years ago. And they do a lot of nifty stuff with staggers with both of them on the court that are generally routinely successful for the team. So, yeah, I definitely think he's the right coach for this team at this point in time.
We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to be back with more of this conversation, so stay tuned. And we're back. So for the Cavs, I think the Pacers do represent, I mean, it's a little different because they're not going to flip, they couldn't flip LeBron for anything. But if you look at the Pacers situation, what do you think is actually something that the Cavs as a franchise could learn from what Indiana has done the last couple of years? Is there something about how they've built the type of play, like just the structure of, is there something the Cavs could emulate as a franchise to learn from Indiana and apply that to it? They're trying to just rebuild from the studs now, functionally, but that they could actually learn and apply to become a successful franchise in a similar market with probably a similar money expenditures or whatever you want to call it. Like, they're very similar to the terms of what they're probably aiming to be.
Right. I mean, as you say, the situations are obviously a lot different because, I mean, I think now the Cavs are leaning towards playing like Sexton and Osman more in late game situations and leaning more on just getting those guys experience, whereas the Pacers were never really in that position with some of their veterans. You know, they weren't, the veterans they were playing weren't going to take minutes away from young guys. So that dynamic is definitely different. But I guess I would look at, you know, some of what I said with even a guy like Big Al and Kyle O'Quinn, I don't know who that player is on the Cavs roster, but I know Kevin Pritchard has emphasized a lot that he can't understate how important that was to them to have players around some of those young players to teach them the importance of realism. And not only just that, but like they're big on, you know, that there's not going to be any entitlements. So just learning, and like at the end of games, Nate goes with whoever has it going. So I think that's part of why their 1 year deals work out because players know, hey, I'm going to earn this. And not that you don't want to give minutes to the young guys on the Cavs roster because they are down to the studs, as you say, but just having, I think that's something I underestimated going into the Kevin Pritchard era because you know, try this guy in the two-way deal. Try this. See if you can take a flyer on a young guy. But I think that the Pacers have kind of shown that it's important to at least have a few strong voices in the locker room that can kind of shepherd those younger players and teach them about being in the NBA and some of the tricks of the trade, even if it's just at practices playing in 4-on-4 sessions. The Pacers have talked about that a lot too, that even if some of their like G League players and others on call-ups aren't getting into games, just being there after a game and getting to go against some of their older players and learn, you know, more about NBA level defense or whatever it may be has been an important part of what they've done. I mean, that might seem like a very small thing, but obviously the comparisons between the two teams and where they're at right now are different. I mean, something else, Richard, just making the Oladipo and Sabonis trade to begin with. Like, I don't know what the plans are with Kevin Love and Tristan Thompson, but I think a lot of times when we look at rebuilds, we think, oh, you have to go after the only two things that you're going after is young talent and draft picks. And that was a big criticism of Kevin Pritchard when that trade was made because they didn't get any lottery picks in return. But in reality, Oladipo and Sabonis have played like lottery picks. So just what lens you look through of what types of deals are made has changed for me, at least through what the Pacers have done.
When you look at the Cavs situation, what do you see as something? If you were them, if you get to the offseason, and obviously you're going to have a top five pick, you're going to have some young players. You'll maybe probably have Kevin Love and Thompson and Nance and these guys around. If you look at the situation as someone who I'm just sort of, I think, warped by it now, by I just have a very clear idea, I think, of what I would do. But if you were able to look at the situation and say, okay, this is the first thing I do, what would you, do you think would be like a good starting point for them actually getting their feet back under them as a franchise?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one because there's so many different paths they could take. I mean, I don't know, like, will they continue to trade some of the players they have? Obviously, I think they want to get out from under J.R. Smith. Would they want to flip Burks and Henson yet at the deadline? I mean, do they want to keep, I mean, this is an honest to good, does it look in the plans to you that they want to keep Kevin Love? I mean, obviously you're not going to sell low on him now because of the injury, but if he comes back at the end of this season and plays, is that a player that from reports sounds like they want to keep Kevin Love as a player to build around?
My read is this. I think if they were able to say what their ideal path would be for next season, it would be that Colin Sexton makes some kind of leap, that Jetty makes some kind of leap, and that Kevin Love and Larry Nance and Tristan Thompson and probably David Nwaba are there. And then I don't know what the heck the rest of the roster looks like, frankly. And Delly will be there, obviously, because if they traded him again or cut him, it'd be like a riot among the fan base. But like that is like the core of the team. I think it's possible Love gets dealt in the summer. I think it's possible Tristan gets flipped. I think those things are not impossible, but I think ideally they would like to try to be better next year and try to be like on the Pistons level. I don't 100% know that to be true. And again, I think if a team comes with a crazy offer for Kevin Love because they miss out on free agents, he becomes maybe not part of their plans. But I think as of right now, it would not shock me if he is part of their plans for next year and beyond.
Right, which that sounds like that was what their plan was going into the season before the injury and the surgery happened. So, yeah, I mean, at that point, you are trying to be kind of, a post-Paul George Pacer team. Obviously, Kevin Love older than Victor Oladipo, but you would be trying to build around a star and find that type of roster balance. I mean, in the Cavs situation with the mid-range shooting, obviously their offense isn't there and their defense isn't there to kind of prop up what they're doing offensively. So I would think that you would want to be looking for shooters. If you're going to try to be competitive, you'd want to put some more shooters out there on the floor to have some of the more balanced scoring that the Pacers have, so that if you're a team like that, or, you know, kind of look at what like the Nets and the Hawks or teams like that do around when you don't necessarily a big all-star player, be more egalitarian possessions in the ball, get lots of ball movement and shoot more threes. I would think that the Cavs would kind of want to take that path. I mean, the Pacers are a little bit different because they're jockeying back and forth for the top defense in the NBA. I mean, I don't necessarily know what the players that the Cavs have going into next year, that they're going to have the potential to have a top 5, top 10, top 15 even defense. So in that case, they might have to start looking, around at, we got to have some shooter. We have to have players with player development that are going to be willing to take some more of these threes and get off the mid-range hamster wheel situation.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I'll wrap it up on this last question. Aside from this, all this roster building talk, when you look at Tuesday's game, Cavs Pacers, 7 p.m. Cleveland, what's something from the last time these two teams played, or just in general with the Pacers, the last couple games that you think people should just keep an eye on as they watch the game?
Right. So that last meeting, I actually watched back some of that in preparation for this, and that might have been the least aesthetically pleasing game
and
of
the
any
last,
two
and
teams.
And the last Cavs and the last Cavs win, frankly, actually, weirdly.
Right. I mean, that was an impressive win for the Cavs to come building. And it honestly, like, one big positive takeaway from that is late in the game, point Nance was like an actual thing. Like, that actually caused some problems. I watched that back in the last 6 minutes, and there was one possession where I know the Cavs have done this sometimes with some of their bigs, but Larry Nance got the ball and punched it ahead off a dead ball, and Sabonis was guarding him and couldn't laterally stay in front. Victor had to come help, and they got like two backdoor cuts off of that. Like, just in the last 2 minutes alone, the Pacers missed 4 free throws. They let Burks drive the full length of the floor for a layup. And then obviously Larry Nance had the game winning putback plus another one. But yeah, definitely the thing that I would watch on Tuesday versus what happened the last time, a lot of what the Pacers are able to do is based off their ability to kill possessions on one end of the floor by forcing turnovers and then get out and transition on the other. And at halftime of that game, they had 0 points off of turnovers. And I think they only ended up forcing 10 turnovers for the game. They just looked really lethargic. I don't know what the reason for that was, because it wasn't like it was the second night of a back-to-back. It was the first night of one for them, which it will be again on Tuesday. So for Cavs fans, I would watch their activity level on the defensive end and see if they're a little bit – I would suspect that they're going to want to get some revenge at that bad loss. And since the next night they're going to be in Boston, I think that they would definitely want to get a win. But, I mean, below 40% for that game. I think the Cavs were right around there too. Like, I think they combined for like 10 threes, the two teams together. It was just not a pretty game at all. So
thanks again to Caitlin Cooper for coming on today's show. Again, find her writing at Indy Cornrows. We'll have full coverage of this game tonight in Cleveland from Golden's Arena. Have game recaps, player grades, the recap up in this feed. So subscribe if you aren't already. Find again the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at Locked On Cavs. You can find me on Twitter and Facebook at CWM Writes. We'll be again back tomorrow recapping tonight's Cavs Pacers game. A whole bunch of game coverage and game preview coverage up at Fear the Sword as well as Trevor Magnotti's excellent draft viewing guide for this week. Again, thanks for listening. Thanks for rating and reviewing this podcast. If you haven't already, please go do so. 5 stars is the best way to support Locked On Cavaliers. and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a great Tuesday. Cheers.